Bell versus Commonwealth, Mr. Childress, and Mr. Sherrill. Y'all may be seated. I take it you both have signed in?
Yes. Yes.
Great. Thank you. All right, the real Mr. Childress.
I am the real authentic Mr. Childress.
The authentic Mr. Yeah. Childress. Okay.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. You have 15 minutes. Would you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I think 5 minutes would be appropriate.
Okay.
May it please the court, my name, as you know, is Jim Childress. I was appointed by the Halifax County Circuit Court to represent Larry Bell in this and some other charges that he had. This one is third offense, distribution of cocaine, where it was 10 to life. He took this charge to a jury, ended up getting 10 years from the jury. Our really sole issue in this case is based on, I guess it's really two issues for the same reason. There were two prospective jurors that I had made a motion to strike them for cause. The court felt that they were sufficiently rehabilitated, and we argued that they had not been, and then we had to use our peremptory strikes to keep them off the jury. So they did make it to that panel of 20 that once we get the peremptory strikes in. So there are lots of cases that involve these sort of fact patterns with prospective jurors. And there was one particularly interesting that was quoted by the Commonwealth in the brief by Ms. Fitzgerald, and that was the Barrett case. In the Barrett case, the court ruled that the prospective juror had been sufficiently rehabilitated, and that was affirmed on appeal. And there were a couple things that came out of that case. One is a prospective juror's either their relationship with a witness in that case, and in the Barrett case, there was a prospective juror's brother was a law enforcement officer and actually going to testify in that case. And in that case, that prospective juror, when asked questions by defense counsel, initially said, and these are very fact-specific, so I may quote, and I apologize for that on the Barrett case. He initially said, no, I'm an impartial person, when asked if he would give any greater weight. So the defense counsel followed up and said, we all have feet made of clay. We're all human. Is there any slight tendency that you would give his testimony, or that officer, I don't know if it was male or female, testimony slightly greater weight than someone else? And he said, well, yes, honestly, yes. And then the court and the Commonwealth followed up with lots of different questions. And what I thought particularly interesting was what the court said, responding to further questions. Number one, that prospective juror said he would not hesitate to put aside his relationship with his brother and his acquaintance with the police officer in judging credibility or believability of their testimony. And I emphasize judging the credibility or believability of that testimony. Two, that he would not favor or show partiality towards his brother's testimony over that of the defendant or defendant's witness. And three, it was actually four, that he did not think that he would have a tendency to believe his brother's testimony over that of someone he did not know or over the testimony of a non-police officer. And four, that he would not show any partiality in favor of his brother's testimony. That was after one admission of bias said, we're all made of clay, we're all humans. Wouldn't there be a slight reason that you would tend to give more weight to your brother's testimony? This case, factually, the situation and the relationship is the same when we're talking about the prospective juror named Lewis. Prospective juror Bennett was not related, but she is friends with an investigator who was going to testify that day. And also, her husband, the testimony was, close friends. So there is a very personal relationship on both of these witnesses. And to the Commonwealth, and I think actually the court had questioned one of these prospective jurors, and that both of those jurors opined in the positive that they would give their family or friends' testimony greater weight over that of someone else. The court and the Commonwealth attempted to rehabilitate that person. And asking fairly leading questions, although those prospective jurors did at times extrapolate on those things, but they were more like, given that relationship, would you give that relationship and that testimony the weight it deserves when looking at the evidence as a whole and things like that. And both jurors said things like, well, of course, if it's evidence, I'm going to look at the evidence for the whole and we'll judge it based on that. So then when it's my turn, I follow up going back to specifically testimony. We're not talking about evidentiary issues or things like that. And I ask just straightforward, a red light, green light situation. If your family or friend says red light, somebody else says green light, doesn't matter who it is, could have been Mr. Bell, are you going to give that weight, that testimony greater weight? And both of them said yes, they would give that testimony greater weight. And then the court and the Commonwealth attempted to rehabilitate, and then, of course, I made the objection that it had not been sufficiently rehabilitated. The court overruled that.
And did the court make a specific finding that those jurors could stand fair and impartial in the cause, or was it implicit in the court's
ruling? It was a very general ruling. So I said, I've got it notated in here exactly what the court said. This was
around appendix 96.
Yes, yes, you're exactly right. So this was on 96, and I said I still have the same motion as far as being rehabilitated enough to overcome that bias. I would say that it's not been done. And the court said, I will note the exceptions for the record and will overrule the objections to these jurors. And that was it. And then we just moved on to the rest of the jurors. And they stayed on the panel.
And what does the law require the judge to do?
The law requires the court, in its discretion, to determine that all the panel, once we get down to 20, is going to be free from exception and bias. And the court, based on its ruling, from what I can tell, thought that that those two jurors had been rehabilitated enough that they were free from exception and bias. So what I'm arguing today is that is a manifest error based on the record, and that amounts to abuse of discretion. One of the other...
Let me just ask you this,
sure.
Counsel. Is there a difference between what happened with either of those jurors? In other words, there's two different jurors. Is one a stronger argument for you than the other, or are they... both on equal footing as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think the family member for Mr. Lewis is probably a stronger case, although we don't know exactly how close. I think they probably should ask some more questions with Mr. Lewis. He says, he's kin, I've known him all my life. And I think it would be hard when you have an unequivocal statement of bias to rehabilitate someone who's made that statement and rang that bell to say, I'm going to ask you to put away your lifelong relationship with this person, even though you've said you would believe their testimony over someone else, and judge their credibility fairly today. Now, with Ms. Bennett, we don't know exactly how long that relationship has lasted. We know that she's friends with, it was Investigator McGregor, but we know her husband is close friends, and she had made a statement that she would be biased.
In this case, Investigator... remember the name of the investigator.
One was McGregor. He was the handler of the confidential.
Yeah, he was a friend of Ms. Bennett, I believe, or a friend of Ms. Bennett's husband.
Yes.
And Emmett Lewis, I guess, was apparently related to Tom Lewis, who was one of the investigators. I'm not sure
correct
what role Investigator Lewis necessarily played in the case, but in the Barrett case that you cited, and as you pointed, these are all fairly fact-specific
yes.
cases. But in the Barrett case, I was on that panel, and my recollection is that the police officer involved there was simply a chain of custody witness as opposed to someone with more
yes.
involvement in the case.
That's
I'm
correct.
Not sure quite the record we have. I'm not sure quite what Investigator Lewis's involvement in the case was, but that might be significant.
Right. So, and it's in the record what his involvement was. Investigator Lewis was essentially the caseworker on the case. This was his case.
The chief investigating officer?
Yes, absolutely. So he's the one who gets in touch with Mike McGregor and says, do you have somebody? Let's work this case up. And he's the one who does everything. McGregor is just simply the person who handles that CI. So Lewis searches the confidential informant before and after. He's the one who handles the buy money, documents all that stuff, sets up the video camera recordings, all those sort of things. He handles the transaction itself.
So in response to Judge Decker's question, would it be fair to say that Investigator McGregor is more akin to Barrett and Investigator Lewis's situation with the other juror is somewhat more involved in that?
I think so. And when we look at how much involvement, credibility came with those two people in the actual case itself, in the merits of the case, it's not going to be dispositive on the issue today. Because the issue today is we still have to have 20 jurors before peremptory strikes to be free from exception and bias. Although it is a circumstance for the court to consider for credibility, and there were a couple cases, there was the Gosling case and also the Mullis case, and in those cases, the court in Gosling said that credibility plays a significant role. So they had to consider that when determining whether that particular person should have been struck. And in Mullis, that credibility played a less significant role. But I would just suggest the court in both those cases, those are really different cases because neither of those people have personal relationships with those prospective jurors and the witnesses. A lot of these cases come down to someone saying, and this is what the Commonwealth cited in the brief with Ms. Fitzgerald, that simply believing a law enforcement officer over someone else is not necessarily grounds, a per se ground, to strike them for cause. But that's not really the issue that we have today.
You're saying the court should have struck the jurors for cause not because of their police officer affiliation, but because of their personal relationship with the jurors.
Correct. That's correct. Yes. And unfortunately, at the time, if just like in Barrett, if I would have made the argument at the trial court that it diminished the integrity of the judicial system, the court actually in Barrett reversed based on that ground, and it appeared sua sponte from the opinion. I did not read the record, but it appears the Townsend case precludes me from making that argument since it's not going to be an injustice argument that I can make. Otherwise, I would have done that. So unless there are any other questions, I think I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Fitzgerald. Good morning.
You said you had a fun trip to Lexington yesterday.
I did have a fun trip to Lexington. Out and back.
There you go.
Save all of my argument for you guys.
Well, that's great. Well, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald, on behalf of the Commonwealth. Both jurors in this case were qualified to serve on the jury, and the trial court did not commit a manifest error amounting to an abuse of discretion in failing to seat them. Despite the initial reservations made by both jurors in this case, both jurors did ultimately say that they were able to put aside their connection to the Commonwealth's witness and put aside, in particular, their acknowledgement that these were law enforcement officers in deciding the evidence in this case.
Well, Mr. Sherrill, let me ask you, I'm frankly more concerned about Juror Lewis than I am about Juror Bennett, because I think Juror Bennett is very close to the Barrett situation, and I'll just lay my cards on the table here. But when you have a juror who says, quote, Tom's father is my first cousin, and I've known Tom all my life, and then the question is asked, would the fact that you know Tom Lewis impair your ability to give the Commonwealth and defense a fair and impartial trial today? And the answer is, I don't think so. And if he'd stop there, we'd probably be done. But he goes on to say, but he is kin. So, you know, there's obviously some question in the juror's mind there. And now, of course, the witness is ultimately rehabilitated to some extent. But, I mean, that's not the only answer he gives that's problematic. And I won't belabor, you know the record probably better than I do. And so, you know, and as your opponent has pointed out, these are very fact-specific, you know, case law. I mean, the per se disqualifications are few and far between, and I think we appreciate the concession this isn't one of those cases. But it is kind of a you-know-it-when-you-see-it approach. And there is some component where, I mean, I can only imagine what the public might think if this particular juror had served on the jury and been the foreman of the jury, and he's the first cousin once removed of the chief investigating officer in the case. To say that that would undermine public confidence in the jury's verdict, I would suggest would be self-evident. So, I mean, where does that leave us?
Well, Your Honor, a couple of things in response. First, I think the depth and breadth of voir dire in this case is significant, and the trial court had the opportunity, you know, to look at him, to analyze his demeanor when he said that, when he made the equivocal statement.
Well, the trial court also expressed some concern about being able to get a jury. You know, if we don't, you know, and I don't know that this is such a high-profile case that in Halifax County is such that you just can't get juries in that town. But that's why we have change of venue procedures. If a situation comes up where you just can't see a jury because of the inability to find fair and impartial people, you move the trial or you bring in a veneer from another jurisdiction.
Sure, Your Honor. And I mean, I think it's also significant, too, that this juror also told the court that he didn't want to be there. So it may be that the court got the sense from this juror that he was trying to give questions that would lend him to be perceived in a certain way. He did say that he would consider evidence that in a situation where it was just word against word in the abstract, he was going to go with a law enforcement officer's testimony, but he said he would be able to consider the evidence.
But isn't that in and of itself pretty problematic? I mean, the question was, if it's word against word, he says, if it's word against word, I'm probably going with Tom and, you know, law enforcement. And then he says, if you've got evidence, then the evidence speaks for itself. And then the Commonwealth tries to rehabilitate him, and he says, I don't know if I could find him guilty.
Well, I mean, I think it's significant that he says right there that if it's just word against word, he wouldn't be able to find him guilty. However, this court has held in Mullis and the Supreme Court in O'Dell and in Morva, which were capital cases, that just in the abstract, believing a law enforcement officer's word over a layperson's word is not enough to show bias.
But what about the personal relationship here? I mean, this isn't based on the fact that they're law enforcement officers. It's based on the fact that they're personal relationship. How does that...
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think that both of the jurors clarified that they would go with that person, law enforcement. They were clarifying that the basis of their opinion in that case was because these folks were law enforcement officers.
Well,
and they knew that
would be
law enforcement officers.
Well, I'm not sure that's true of Juror Lewis, who seemed to emphasize the fact that he was talking about his cousin that he grew up with. I mean, he happened to be a law enforcement officer, but I think, as Judge O'Brien just pointed out, I think really the basis for whatever implied bias there might be there is not based on law enforcement, it's based on relationship, you know, familial relationship.
Sure, and the trial court, of course, was in the best position to make that determination, seeing what emphasis they put on those words and how they were talking when they spoke about these witnesses. I think it's also significant...
Well, where do we draw the line? If my brother, if I'm prosecuting the case or, and my brother winds up on the jury and he says, oh, I could be fair and impartial... You know, do we seat my brother on the jury? Do we excuse him for cause? Or if the judge decides that my brother is truthful when he says he can be impartial, we go ahead and seat him? And, you know, I mean, how would that look?
Well, and there might be a public perception a problem in that case, right? But that's not the case we have here. And I think it's also...
How many degrees is consanguinity? Is it like marriage where, you know, it's okay if you're a third cousin to get married or something? But, I mean... How do we do this?
Sure. I think a significant distinction in this case is that that officer's testimony was never at issue in this trial. This credibility was not at issue in this trial. This is a case where we had a videotaped, audio-recorded drug transaction where the defense was that the CI coerced this person into selling her drugs. The CI's credibility was at issue. That this person sold drugs, that there were drugs, that it was cocaine, was never at issue. This is not a case like Gosling where the correctional officer's testimony was
pivotal. Is that a harmless error argument you're making there? The jury never should have been seated, but it really doesn't matter?
No, Your Honor. It's because the bias that we're talking about wasn't relevant. This person wasn't biased in a relevant way. And this court relied on that in Mullis. It was a determination in Mullis that there they held that the officer's testimony wasn't a central issue in that case.
Well,
and here,
McGregor was a witness who basically bolstered the confidential informant's testimony, didn't he? Said she's made buys for me or he's made buys for me 31 times, and when the confidential informant, I guess the informant, not confidential, was testifying, when their credibility becomes the issue, the bolstering of the credibility by a witness is significant, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. However, I think the police officer's testimony was, I didn't know any of these things about her. I didn't know she was using drugs. And that was elicited from on cross-examination, and I think it came out in the Commonwealth's case in chief as well. There was no, you know, she's great, I know her, I've always known her, she's never done anything wrong. In fact, the officer's testimony was, we had no idea she was doing this. She picks the confidential informant. We didn't know she was using drugs. Had we known she was using drugs, we wouldn't have used her in this case.
Doesn't that make the officer's testimony or the fact that a juror would believe that officer, is more inclined to believe that officer, doesn't that make that more relevant?
No, Your Honor, because what we're focusing on here is the confidential informant's credibility and what the confidential informant did in these cases. The police officers testified that this action was not normal for her. Essentially, they didn't know what was going on with her in this case.
He also testified that she accurately reported what happened during the previous 31 buys.
Well, the jury in this case could see what happened in this case, could look at the video, could hear the audio. What happened in other cases is not relevant to whether this man sold these drugs to this person
under
this circumstance.
I think what Jacob Bryan is getting at is a very good point, as far as I'm concerned at least, is that the officer, while the case relies ultimately on a confidential informant's testimony, it's the credibility of the confidential informant comes from the officer, the officer's involved. So it's once removed, I guess, just like the familial relationship between the juror and the officer here. But so, I mean, analytically, it doesn't seem to me to make a lot of difference. The officer's testimony is still fairly important to determining, in this case, the credibility of the confidential informant.
I think I would disagree, Your Honor, in that in this case, when we're talking about buying and selling a controlled substance, we have the defendant selling uncontestedly a controlled substance on video to a confidential informant. The jury saw the video, the jury heard the audio. They could draw their own conclusions from that testimony. It wasn't, in the case of Gosling or a correctional officer, it's a he said, she said situation. It's a situation that was set up by that stoplight hypothetical, red light, green light. This is a situation where those officers were not placing their word against the word of another person in this case. And to go back to the voir dire, I think we need to give heavy deference to the trial court's determination in this case. These people were extensively and exhaustively voir dired on whether they could stand impartial in this case. In the trial court's determination, there is a factual finding, which is entitled to deference in this court. And although they gave different answers at different times, they all ultimately said unequivocally that they would be able to put aside what they knew of these people. The trial court also noted that this is a small jurisdiction, and that's at Appendix 72. It's a small community. Everybody knows the first responders. Everybody knows the person who works in the hospital, who sees all the officers as they come and go. It may be that in a jurisdiction this size, it's difficult to pick a jury where not everyone knows everyone. And we're dealing again here with someone who is the first cousin once removed. It's not the defendant's brother.
But does all that go? Does that all that factor into whether somebody's entitled to a free and fair and impartial jury? In other words,
no, Your Honor. I just think that it's a situation that occurs regularly, and people are able to put aside these kind of multiple degrees of separation. And what we're looking at is whether this juror can. I think the quote is that it's a assessment of a current state of mind and a prediction of future behavior. This person, as they stand here, they may have come in with preconceptions, but they're able to put aside what they know and decide this case fairly based on the evidence as it is presented to them. And people do come to court with family members, with biases, with preconceived notions, but it's the trial court's job to decide based on their demeanor, based on their tone, based on their conscientiousness as they sit there, whether they're going to be able to do that. And the trial court in this case certainly had ample opportunity to observe these folks while they were making their testimony and ultimately decided that they were fit to serve on this jury. I'd be happy to answer further questions.
Yes,
could you affirm? Thank you.
Mr. Childers, you've got a little under 4 minutes.
All right, thank you. And I really just have three main topics to hit. Well, I guess two with two subparts. First, when we're talking about whether the person has been rehabilitated or not, this court has ruled in Griffin at 625 and Gosling, 7 Court of Appeals, 642 at 646, and I'm going to quote this, a prospective juror's subsequent statement that he can give the defendant a fair and impartial trial is not dispositive when preceded by a positive, unequivocal testimony of bias. And that's the issue of when these two people have a significant relationship, one's known and related to this person their entire life, and the other, their husband, is close friends. You cannot not know someone your spouse is close friends with and have that personal relationship. And she said she had that personal relationship. Saying in the general sense, can you be fair and impartial, is not going to rehabilitate that person. So I think if the trial court had made the findings like the findings were made in Barrett, it would be a little different. And if there were questions specifically on setting aside the credibility issue, not the fair and impartial as a general sense, then we'd have a different issue here today. So there's a distinction, I think, between a credibility argument and when someone says, I'm going to be biased based on this person's testimony versus fair and impartial as a whole. So lastly, I think there is a harmless error argument here, although the credibility issue, whether that credibility at trial on the merits is an issue based on the issue for the prospective juror bias. Courts have, and this court has looked at it as a something to consider. It is not dispositive by any means, and if the court feels that it could be harmless error, there, of course, credibility in these sort of cases is almost always an issue. You have to believe the CI and not believe the defendant.
I'm not sure, to be honest with you, I'm not sure how you do a harmless error analysis in a situation like this, because, as you pointed out, the error is not having a jury free of bias.
Right.
And so once the trial has begun and you have a jury that's not free of bias, how would you ever be able to say that the error was harmless?
Right.
Since you would never know, you know, unless you're recording everything that goes on in the jury room, you would really never know what impact that.
I think you're exactly right, and I'm glad the court's taking that position. So,
I'm not sure the court is. But it's just a question that I'm drawing to you.
Yes. So I think that's the right analysis to take, and what the law says, you have to have 20 people free from exceptions and bias, and that's not what we had in this case. But additionally, things always come up during jury trials. You never know what to expect, and in this case, Mr. Bell decided not to testify at the last minute, and we don't know exactly what played into that. In jury trials, occasionally jurors will nod along to the Commonwealth and not make eye contact with defense counsel, or the other way around. And it's all those things that go into conditions to decide whether you're going to testify or not to testify. And my client, based on who knows what, decided not to testify. But things could have been different if we could have used two additional peremptory strikes on other people and not the people that should have been struck for cause. So other than that, I'll rest on my argument and arguments in brief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll come next.